it make both isotactic, or what we call crystalline and amorphous, polymer, and they would separate it by acetone solution into the high molecular weight and the more amorphous. And this, I was really going all out to figure out how in the world I was going. The melting point was only about 70 to 80 degrees. And how in the world do you get this? Well, maybe way in the early stages, I'm trying to figure the thing here. As I got to fooling around with polymers, I didn't know a thing about polymers. I was working strictly on observation. Didn't know a thing about polymerization, didn't know anything. So I went, this is where I went to Brooklyn Polytech for 6 weeks, or 3 weeks, I guess it is. I don't remember if it's three or six. I think it's three. Course at Brooklyn Polytech, because I felt that was the best place, well, it was by far then, the best place to go. And Turner Alfrey was the director of the school that year. And Mark was there, and Overberger was there, and what this guy, Moravia?
Morowitz.
Huh?
Morowitz.
The guy that went to, Marowitz was there, but it seemed like there's another Moravian there. It was all, they were all good guys. And I learned, man, I did learn a lot, I'll tell you. I learned what polymerization was all about, you know. And it's been the basis then for me to think on ever since. And they taught us a lot in that period of time. Taught us an awful lot.
Did anyone else from Dow go at the same time, or were you the only one?
I don't believe. I believe I was the only one from Dow. I believe I was the only one.
Were there other industrial people?
Oh, yeah. I don't really recall. There was a girl there who was very good in math. I don't recall now any of the other people who were there. Really. I remember the professors well. I remember that old Turner Alfrey, we had our, when we finished the day we finished, we had a big beer bust right there in the lake. And he had a card tied up for, see who could kick that card as we kept raising it, you know. we had a big time. I enjoyed that. Learned a lot. Really did. Really did. They were good at it, and so I met Mark, and I met Turner, and I met Overberger, and I met I'm going to say Messeravian. Is that name right?
I'm not sure. We can check that. I'm not
Messeravian. He went with some, I won't say tin company, but anyway, there's about four of them there. Yeah, I came back, and that. Oh, that helped me immensely as far as understanding what was going on, you know. Well, then we kept going with this polymer thing. And then right after that, not long, I don't know, maybe a year or so after that, Turner came to Dow and became, you know, a very important polymer man up here with Ray Bowyer and others. And I was still trying to figure out how to get the molecular weight up, make this in. See, I was trying to make it into a plastic, which it's really not suited as a, I don't know, you just can't get that molecular weight up. I don't care what you do, I mean the melting point. You can just keep carrying the molecular weight out and it don't go up. It just don't go up. But anyway, I invited Turner Alfrey to come down to Texas one time. I says, come down here and show me and tell me what I got to do. Well, I was real disappointed in Turner. He came down and looked around and went home and offered not one suggestion. Well, what it turned out was this was a completely, see, I was in a whole new field that nobody knew anything about. Nobody. I didn't realize that. And he's a vinyl polymerization man. And this was ionic polymerization in glycols, which he had no experience. And he couldn't offer any better suggestion than I had because he didn't know. He didn't have any experience. But I kind of got disillusioned with the experts because I figured they'll come down and give me the answer. But I could see over the years why that was true. And we were plowing completely new ground. And then Charlie, your man up there, Charlie
Price.
Charlie Price. I want to say, Charlie Price started picking up doing this same kind of work. He had been playing around with KOH and propylene oxide, making mostly liquids. And man, he was really intrigued with this idea that you could make solids. So he did a lot of work himself on this problem, and we had a lot of correspondence. I'd never met Charlie Price, but we had a lot of conversation on the phone and letters. And he had a lot of good thoughts, and we worked together a good bit. Then a fellow named Furukawa over at Kyoto University picked up on this. Became a very good friend of mine. Came to the U.S., and I went over to see him a time or two. And he worked in this field awful lot. Now, the thing was, if Dow had been a rubber company, see, it turns out it's a rubber done right. If we had been a rubber company, we understood rubber. I'm not so sure that PO polymers wouldn't be a good rubber today before all these others caught on. If you ever get established, you know, you're in pretty good shape. Because with the proper work, which has never really been done on PO because it turns out now it's too high, compared to some of the others, but it made a very stable rubber and a very high-low temperature rubber, so forth. But never, just couldn't make a plastic. I was trying to make a plastic out of it. But anyway, I did a lot of that work on the ionic polymerization. In 1965, just to follow up on this then, the Japanese had a big EPAC meeting on ionic polymerization in Kyoto University. Furukawa, those people were handling it, I guess. And I was invited. Only three industrial people were invited. Me, what's the guy from DuPont, and then he went to Massachusetts, starts with a V. Volker?
Yes.
Volker. Volker at that time was with DuPont. Volker was invited, and the guy from Hercules that did the epi work for them, I can't think of that name. You don't know that name?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
We were the three people invited, only three industrial people in the world. And they, at that meeting, they had all these fancy names I'd been reading in reports and articles around the world from Russia, England, and Canada, and Japan, and everywhere else. Man, they had a room full of these people. And they went on for 2 days, and I sat there quietly and listened. And I got a little disillusioned. They'd bring up problems, and I said to myself, if that's a problem, they could solve that in 15 minutes if they just go do the right experience. It looks like all they want to do is just talk about it. And I think that. Anyway, so at the end, Charlie Price got up to summarize the conference, Charlie Price. And I was sitting back there with a little Volker. And he says, you know, we've been going on 2 days now, and the father of ionic polymerization is here with us, but we haven't heard from him. And I said to myself, I wonder who that is. And he said, it's Mac Pruitt, the alchemical company. But I never dreamed, you know. But they were giving me credit for having done the first ionic polymerization through this work, which by patent and everything, I guess that's right. But I never dreamed about it. Anyway, he was very complimentary, and I thought, well, gee, McCrick's no wonder I'm invited, you know. Because I kind of wondered why I was invited with all this room full of all these expert academic guys, you know. So, let's see now. Okay.
Would you say that's the difference between an industrial chemist and an academic person? The academics seem to talk about it while you just went ahead and did the experiment.
Yeah. Well, a little bit. Now, not everybody, but I think there are a lot of academic people, if they solve the problem, wouldn't have anything to talk about. I was serious. They get up and I knew a lot about some of the things they were talking about. I knew, see, I had also resolved earlier in my career that my goal in life, this is before Dow started pushing me every direction, that I was going to become, and I did this because another thing I had done about the second year I was in research there, I decided to go down to the University of Houston and get my master's degree. And I talked to Earl about it, you know, the director, and he thought it okay. So three of us guys drove to Houston twice a week to start taking a master's in chemistry. Well, they were just setting up their master's. They just started, and they just had one woman, a lady, who was kind of running the organic part, and she was teaching these courses at night, and just us three and her. They set them up specially for us. We were kind of breaking in their masters, you know. And this lady, who was, by the way, I thought an excellent teacher and a very good chemist, she was absolutely scared to death of us. That we, here in three big industrial chemists, and we probably knew twice as much as she did, which wasn't true, but all she would do is sign, read chapters so-and-so, and she wouldn't hardly, well, sometimes she wouldn't even come, she'd just miss. And I think she got to the point where she'd absolutely scared to death to come meet with us, afraid we was going to embarrass her, you know.
And do you remember her name?
No, I don't. I can see her face.
What about the text you were reading from?
Well, it was, I think the text we were using was Gilmer. I think it was the text we studied from. You know Gilmer?
Gilmer or Gilman?
Gilman, yeah.
Gilman.
Yes. Gilman. Yeah, okay, Gilman. Okay. And anyway, I finally decided, I went back there and told him, I said, I think I can learn more by just concentrating on my job and studying on my own when I need to know something, rather than going doing that till they get themselves set up in a more, you know, so I never did go back.
Did the others continue or did they?
No, they quit too. They quit too. But I think now they've got a nice program. But, you know, in the early stages, it just wasn't enough there to do much with. Now, I did take physical chemistry down there under Dr. Drake. Remember him? He's a crippled fellow. Man, he was good. I retook a physical chemistry or a little, I don't know whether it was advanced course or, but that helped me because I was working so much in ACU or North Texas, I didn't get a very good course in physical chemistry. And I was working so much with gases and all these conditions, you know, that physical chemistry was very essential. So I took a course in that from Drake, who had been there for years and teaching this. And man, he was really good. And that really helped me. But we didn't learn hardly anything out of this organic course except what we just read for ourselves, you know.
I have some other notes here, things that happened around this time, in looking through your patents. I was struck by the fact that you have two patents on plant growth medium. How did that...
Yeah, well, okay. Now, see, when I was over at Plant A, in the semi-plant setting, most of my work was in alkaline oxides of some sort, most of it. You know, either the polymerization of, or the derivatives of, or lubricants of, and so forth. And we had come up, we had one patent, you see, in there, where we made the triols of glycerin, which is a very vital product. It is the guts of the urethane business today. And, of course, at that time, we didn't know anything about urethanes. We were trying to make it into a good detergent, a surfactant. And then we moved over to Plant A into the new research center, and I had a new building and a new lab and became director of search of organic product development lab. And I began to take on quite a few things. And one of the things was some of our people out in the field, our salespeople, had spotted the idea, say, your thing is taking off in Europe, and they're showing their head just a little in this country, people looking at them. But wasn't anything going on. And I said, well, I looked into that. I said, okay, if nobody else in Dow, I'm going to become the urethane man in Dow. And I'm going to work that technology up. So I went to work real hard with my people, setting up one group on the polyol side and one group on the urethane side, developing the urethane. So we came up with all kind of urethanes, catalysts, and we got polyols, and all the technologies therewith. And of course, the first thing we shot after was flexible foam, you know, making polyols to make flexible foam for furniture and so forth, bedding. And we came up, carbide was coming up right with us, and maybe one or two others, all competing, but we was right there from the first, maybe the first, you know. And we had a good products, good system, and we've been big in this, you know, a long time. So I put Dow into the urethane business. And time went on. This Joe Baggett, who worked kind of, he was a kind of a loner, he was a kind of a sloppy, he didn't hardly know one molecule from another, but I used him all the time to work with me to do things that I wanted carried out, and he had a lot of serendipity to observe things and then come back and tell me about them. A lot of other people wouldn't. And so as we begin to make these flexible foams, we begin to, I don't know, I can't tell you for exactly what got me onto this, but see, I got this patent all along. Then I signed Joe to spend more time, and then a guy named Mel Hanley. But we found out that we could put nutrients and foam them in place in this foam, and they would be ideal growing media. And it's a heck of a good idea, except you're trying to replace dirt. That's pretty hard to do. Pretty hard to do. But we began to experiment. What we wanted is permanency, where that nutrient would stay there. See, if you just put a soluble salt, well, in no time it's gone. We started putting salt that would stay in there and leach out slowly and would last for years. And you know, these slow-growing houseplants, we could put them in there and it'd stay 3 or 4 years. All you had to do is put a little water on them. That's all. You know? And grow fine. Great. If you knew how to do it. And in fact, I've got a Christmas cactus in my house today that stayed in one of those foams 14 years without anything except water. And then it began to play out, and I had to put dirt around it and start doing different, but 14 years. And especially were they good for orchids. You know, they like a kind of a funny... And we actually got a guy up in East Texas there to actually set up a big greenhouse, and he just grew orchids like mad in these things. And then a company in Houston actually went in the bin and set up a production line to make these Nutrifoam pots. But just couldn't make enough money out of them, you know. People really like to play in dirt. And they just, so we decided, yeah, there's just not enough there. This company went at this a good while, but they finally pulled away, I think. But that's, we call it Nutrifoam. It's a great idea. We had a greenhouse out there just full of everything under the sun growing in this. It's just beautiful. Just beautiful. You know? But not really a good commercial deal. Right. I was trying. I tried, you know, in my career through there in Texas, I was trying all kind of oddball things like that, you know, because it's interesting, and you never know when one of them might click, but it shows you where there's a reason why it's just not going to be commercially. You just can't continue to spend money on it.
You're working on ionic polymerization, then. Is that one of the reasons you moved away from that? Because you did some of the early work, but it was never you never really published it that much or pursued it within the company. Is that true?
Oh, we never published anything outside the company. I never wrote. I don't think I ever wrote a paper outside the company. That last thing I wanted to do, tell somebody else what was
doing. No, I understand, but I guess what I'm after is the fact that the ionic polymerization work did not continue that. You moved on to other areas then.
Oh, yeah. I had to, they were demanding that I do other things, and yeah, I began to broaden out into all kind of areas. The PO polymer, I just couldn't get it up to be a plastic. We had nobody in Dow who could look at it as a elastomer. And I wasn't very experienced in elastomers, so we just didn't. Now, one other development out of this over the period, and we continued on this off and on quite a bit, and we got with Goodyear one time. Had a joint venture company in research where they would try to put it into a rubber, especially rubber. but that time they had already developed these ethylene, propylene tri rubbers and a lot of other rubbers, isoprenes and stuff that they'd put so much money into them that, you know, just no way for this order to get there. But I thought for a while Goodyear, but they finally decided, well, we just can't afford that many different rubbers. I thought they was going to really put it over because they had a pilot plant, Goodyear, working with us very closely on making PO rubber for specialties. But, you know, you can just spend so much money on so many projects, and the others were so far along, and I don't know, probably cheaper now. Because PO oxide and those are pretty high now, so I don't know. But in the end of the PO polymer, where I was trying to figure out how to get that molecular weight up, change the molecular weight, raise the melting point, the big problem was molecular weight. How in the world do you measure molecular weight, and particularly molecular distribution? So, with a fellow named John Moore, you've heard, I'm sure, was there and working in the basic research. And I got Earl, let him sign him to me, and his job was to figure out, you see, up in Midland, up here, you know, people like Lou Ho-Tung, and you know Lou Ho-Tung? He's one of Dow's kind of basic characterizing polymer men, and all the people, you know, Ray and Turner and all those people, all they had was sand filters and centrifuges, and, you know, and all that's a mess. Ain't worth a dime, for I'm concerned. And so I signed Johnny Moore. You figure out a way to determine the molecular weight of polymers and the molecular distribution. So he went to work on this, and he got a pretty devious mind. And we started out first trying to see if we could do it by end groups. But, you know, it got so, we was getting up to 100, 200, 300 molecular weight. And there's no way you could get the distribution anyway. Well, it looked pretty discouraging. But somehow or another, he stumbled on the idea of beads would separate polymer size. I guess you know what I'm leading to, if you're a polymer man at all. And that began to look better and better and better. That you could take a very dilute solution of polymer, put it through a bead column, and you could come out with the molecular weight and the molecular distribution. and we invented gel permeation chromatography. Probably the best tool polymer has ever and ever will have. Are you familiar with GPV much?
To a certain extent.
Well, boy, if you're not, you ought to get more acquainted with it. That is absolutely unbelievable. Well, even with that, we still couldn't figure out any way to get the melting point up. But about that time, see, we had gotten in the, and I was right in the middle of this, we'd got involved in polyethylene. We'd bought the ICI process. We'd built a plant. And I wasn't backing up the existing product lines. That was done by the manufacturing groups. But I was involved in trying to find new copolymers of polyethylene or new things, like, for instance, the ethylene acrylic acid copolymers, which is now just now beginning to be big business, and all kind of things. Then we got in such trouble with our polymer line, because this is where I was just telling the new research director yesterday, don't ever let sales business people and the manufacturing people get involved in backing up your products alone without research, because you'll go to pot every time. And we got in such trouble with our products, we were losing $2 million a month on polyethylene. This is way back then. And so they were going to just flush it out. Well, a guy named Brooke down in Texas and myself decided, hey, give us a shot. We'll take the research. I'll take the research. Brooke took the manufacturing. We started trimming the product lines out, and if I hadn't had GPC, I'd never made it. But I'm telling you, you put a polymer in that GPC machine, and it, in 2 hours, or an hour, it'll plot out the molecular weight and distribution. And if you get the same molecular distribution curve, you've got exactly the same polymer every time. Every time. So we could take a carbide product or anybody else and get the molecular distribution where they had a good product eating us up with it. And then we could slowly, right quickly, we could duplicate that and find out how to make a product similar to that or one even better in no time with this instrument. So, boy, we improved that product line overnight. You know, they thought we'd perform miracles, which we had. And we got the polyethylene line back on track and made a fortune out of it for years, you know. But that was due to GPC. GPC is unbelievable, too, and I think everybody in the polymer business knows it. Well, now, I don't know whether this ought to be on record or not, but we could get no attention to this instrument in Midland. None. Absolutely none. I come up and pled with them, because we were already doing great things in polyethylene. And this includes Ray Bandy, Ray Bollier, Turner Alford, Lou Hotung, all of them. Well, I think it's this idea, you know, where these little young upstarts down there don't know what they're doing. They couldn't have anything, I guess. I don't know. I tried to hit the sales department to use it in their advertising, show how good we were in polymer. So one day I told Ray Bollier and Ray Bandy, well, if you don't think this thing's very important, I'm going to go sell it, because there are people going to be on our back and going to invent this, and Dow's going to lose out. They said, well, fine. I didn't look back. I went home, got our local lawyer down there in Dow, and I sold this to Waters Associates. Are you familiar with Waters?
Yes.
Little upstart company. This guy Waters, he didn't hardly have anything, but it's the best thing we ever did, because he was willing to put a lot of development time and money into it. Whereas somebody like Foxborough or somebody would probably just done another product, you know, and it might have fallen. Anyway, we went to work with that company and started developing GPC, and man, for no time, we had this all over the industry. And John Moore, who was the inventor, he developed this thing. A guy named John Moore was in demand to make talks all over the world. Now, mainly to the analytical type folks.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he did a lot of it to help Waters promote the product.